I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right. Welcome to Kernels. I hope you've been good since the 2 weeks since we last spoke. Our guest on the podcast today is Jason Blum, who's a Hollywood producer who, I mean, this is hyperbole, but it's kind of like the Robin Hood a little bit of the indie world, in that he tends to finance cheap to make horror films, you know, found footage, Paranormal Activity, that kind of stuff, that have these huge profit margins, which then gives him, you know, the money to be able to put behind films like Whiplash and get that stuff made. So hopefully it'll be an interesting insight into kind of the workings of Hollywood micro budgets and indies. But first, I just wanted to talk a little bit about a 2015 film that I've been meaning to watch for months, just kind of got lost, but I finally managed to get around to this week, called Victoria. It's a German thriller. And it's, you might have heard of it, it's a single-shot film. It's over 2 hours long, and the entire thing is one take, literally from second one till the credits roll. Just one camera, one cameraman, which is brave, risky, and a technical nightmare. I mean, often with those kind of films, if you do have a really long single take, it will tend to be in one place. So you had like Birdman, for instance, which actually wasn't a single take. I love Birdman, but what they did, you know, they would have the camera pan up to the sky, and then they could cut there, and then blend it in with another one that begins. So you had the feeling of a continuous take, but without having to worry about nailing the whole film in one go. Whereas this, they literally did do it completely. And yeah, that usually means a single location, like in Birdman, which is set in a theatre. But this goes all around. So it's set in Berlin and starts off in a club. It moves on to a cafe. You know, without spoiling it, later we go up to rooftops, all around the streets, in the back of cars. It's crazy when you think about it, and you think about all the crew that have got to move with it. You know, the camera operator, the assistant directors, the sound guy, you know, people looking out for lighting, people to, you know, assistant directors who are then organizing and giving routines to all the extras who have to be just so. And it's initially hard to, I don't know, if you're a film fan, it's hard to kind of watch in a way without constantly thinking about what's going on the production side of things. But it's very interesting because of that, and it really works. That's what really struck me, is like, I've been intrigued to watch it for a while, but I thought that, you know, it might have been, did they need this to be a single take film, or were they just, you know, thinking that's a nice gimmick that, you know, will get press coverage, which it did, and might get us into film festivals? But it actually makes a lot of sense, because it's set in one night in Berlin, a kind of crazy night. You do really get a real sense that you're there, having the camera. You know, there's very rarely any wide shots, because that would involved the cameraman having to back off loads and then come back in close again, which would be odd. So the camera, for the most part, is, you know, mid shots or close ups. So you really get to know the characters very quickly, because you're constantly with them and following them around. The vibe's not so much like voyeurism, it's more like you're there with them. And because, you know, it's a little bit rough around the edges, the camera is intentionally jerky, but you're aware that there's a camera operator there behind it, which makes you behind the lens feel like you are a character with them. And the film's kind of genre, it's an interesting piece, because it starts out, you don't really know what genre it is. It's just a girl in a club partying, starts talking to some guys outside. You're not sure, like, they seem like they're kind of friendly but don't have a best interest necessarily at heart, and you're a little bit worried for her. And then it kind of mellows out a little bit for a while, and it seems like it's going into a drama. There's this quite nice, almost romantic scene. And then, again, without giving too much away, the tension ratchets up and it becomes absolutely nail-biting by the end. And it was even shot right at the end of the night so that the sun would come up during the film. So you literally start in complete darkness and end in total light, which is quite cool to see. It's like literally waking up and going through the morning on no sleep with these people. And another thing that really struck me about it, you know, beyond all the fact that you've got a walkie-talkie ahead to people who are in the next location to tell them that the characters are about to move up to where they are, and the fact that the actors have to presumably ad-lib a lot because, you know, things are going to change on the route. It's not going to be as meticulously script supervised as a film that has cuts in it would. So what amazed me was that, not in addition to all of that, the film takes most of its risks in right at the end. So it's a bit like kind of setting up some dominoes and then putting this really elaborate kind of tricky bit where one of them's likely to fall down without knocking the rest in kind of the end of the run. And that's what kind of what the film does. So it's amazing. I think they did it in 3 takes. So it's a admirable and ultimately very successful, I think, experiment. So if you get a chance to check it out, do. All right, now we'll catch up with my colleague Jacob, who has been chatting to Jason Blum. So Jacob, you chatted to Jason Blum this week, who, for listeners who might not know, is a producer, but kind of like a more like a specialist producer, I guess.
Yeah, he's a funny one. He's kind of carved a niche in horror, because I think the first horror he did was Paranormal Activity, and it was hugely profitable. And I think he saw an opportunity, and he's done lots of films like Insidious, Sinister, The Purge, and their sequels. But he also does, like, if you look through his list of credits, he does smaller independent films as well, like Whiplash. He did Whiplash,
yeah,
and others, which is interesting.
So he sort of almost does one to beget the other.
Yeah,
the markup on, not the markup, the profit on those films is insane, isn't it?
Like,
I think
insane.
The budget for Paranormal Activity is $15,000, and it went on to make just under $200 million.
It's one of like the highest grossing in relation to budget. It's,
yeah,
I think it's one of
the most
biggest
profitable like film. Kind of movie you can make a found footage horror.
Yeah, and I think I kind of asked him about that, which everyone will get to hear, and he had a view on it,
right?
Yeah, which is quite interesting. But he obviously now this year he had huge unprecedented success with Get Out, which just took on a life of its own, and the Daniel Kaluuya film. I think it's like the highest grossing debut for an original screenplay, for Jordan Peele, which I think before that it was Blair Witch Project, which was pretty impressive.
Yeah,
and I think if he's pushing that, you know, in the horror genre, he's definitely become a name now that will always be associated with it.
Yeah, he is very well known, isn't he, among Hollywood for what he does.
Yeah,
I guess with Get Out, because it seems like his thing is, you know, to do a lot of horror films, and then that enables him to like sneak in a Whiplash, which, even though it was such a talked about film, isn't that profitable. It didn't make a crazy amount of money,
no.
but it's a nice thing to do because it's good that got made.
Completely.
And I guess Get Out's almost like a good marriage of the two, because it's a horror film that will nail that audience, but it's also a bit more, it's trying to achieve more than like a Insidious Chapter 3 or something, isn't
it?
It's
so much more than just another film about a ghost or a demon or something.
Yeah.
That is going to spawn an unnecessary sequel.
Yeah,
but what is quite interesting is I noticed that he hasn't ever remade anything. He's touched a few old horror classics, but not huge ones. So I think he's doing another Amityville film, and he did another one called The Town That Dreaded Sundown. But he kind of subverted that by making that film exist within the film. Like,
yeah.
The original film existed within this film, but he's actually doing another Halloween one, and he's actually doing it with John Carpenter, who we spoke about quite a lot. So
yeah,
I think that's
yeah.
obviously a huge influence, and it's going to be quite exciting to see what he does there.
Yeah, it's interesting that he doesn't try and do sequels, because you think if you're in the business of making like a buck on horrors, you know, you'd push everything.
You may as well.
But it's interesting that he's like trying to forge out new ones.
He had a good good answer. I kind of asked him about sequels and his view on them, and whether they were as fun or whether he could be as creative. And he kind of broke down his the ratio of what he does between TV and films, and within the film sector of percentage of sequels to original properties. And it's just quite funny speaking to a producer about that, because he's obviously got it in his head all the time of what he wants to do, and it's a numbers game, I guess.
Yeah,
ultimately it's a numbers game.
Yeah, you and me like spend most of our time interviewing I guess, a 50-50 split of actors and directors, didn't we?
Yeah.
But not often, really, producers. Did you? I mean, it's hard to get it from one person, but it was a different kind of, different vibe, do you think? Or
he was, I mean, I don't know what I expected, but he wasn't, I kind of expected someone smaller, maybe with a cigar hanging out the window. But no, he was, I think that producers, I mean, I think Jason Blum had an air of confidence that maybe a director wouldn't have.
Yeah. Because they have to be, don't they? A producer has to be the confident guy who can say, this is worth putting this many millions of dollars behind, kind of thing.
And, you know, he says yes or he says no.
Yeah.
And then people studio-wide listen to that. And if it's a success or not, it's kind of down on him. He's a very intelligent man, I could tell. He's passionate about film. And I kind of like the films that he does. Even the horror films that would be throwaway in other people's hands. I think he kind of makes them watchable and
I don't find myself watching a lot of horrors, but then the ones I have seen often do tend to come from Blumhouse, like The Purge and
and I feel like when you see that weird logo, that creepy girl at the beginning, you kind of think I'm in safe hands now.
You know you're gonna get a quality like schlocky horror, like,
yeah,
if that
definitely,
makes sense.
Definitely.
All right, well, we're looking forward to hearing it. And who you got coming up, interviews-wise? You're doing out doing some today, right?
Yeah, I did Jessica Chastain, the very lovely Jessica Chastain. And
which was for?
That was for Miss Sloane, the John Madden film. And it's,
When I heard that name, I assumed it was like the American football commentator. I was like, that is a daring role.
A daring role for Chastain, yeah. She's expanding her oeuvre. But yeah, man, that was good. And Kevin Bacon, who seemed very depressed about the fact that he was more famous for being Kevin Bacon than his acting
roles.
Abilities. Yeah, I didn't know what to say, really.
What does it mean to be Kevin Bacon? I don't know what that Kevin Bacon-ness is.
I think it was a mixture of the Six Degrees of Separation game, the Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon, and the E! Adverts. I brought up the E! Adverts.
Oh, man.
I had to bring up the E! Adverts, man.
Yeah,
I had to.
That's fair.
It seemed remiss of me not to. But no, yeah, that's pretty cool.
All right, well, thanks for contributing to the podcast, as always.
Mate, my pleasure.
Oh, and I forgot to mention, our mic gave out towards the end of the interview, so if you're wondering why the quality suddenly dramatically drops, it's because the last bit was caught on the fly on iPhone. All right, enjoy.
Okay.
You can make a horror film about that, I tell
that
you.
That would be a good, yeah. That would be a good scary movie.
Man, it's good to meet you. I was happy to get the email that you're in town. I'm currently reading the Robert Evans memoir, The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Yes.
And I'm actually considering quitting journalism, upping sticks, and becoming a producer.
I encourage it.
It's incredible. So that leads me to my first question, which is, what led you to this profession? Why do you do what you do?
Well, a lot of things led me to the profession, but I think one of the big things is I grew up around art. My dad was an art dealer. My mom was a professor of art history, so I was always, exposed to art at a very young age. I think one of the things about contemporary art when I was young, which is, you know, in the 70s and 80s, was that it was very, very elitist.
Mm-hmm.
It's much less elitist now than it was in that time, but then the contemporary art world was very small, and so I was always fixated on trying to do art for a much bigger group of people. Why that is, I don't know, but that's what kind of led me to movies at a very young age.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're obviously, first and foremost, you're known for horror projects.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that led you to that genre initially?
To scary movies?
Yeah,
Blumhouse is like genre thriller, horror, all those things. So I was an independent producer. I worked for the Weinsteins. I worked for Miramax for about 5 years, from 95 to 2000. And then I quit, started my own company, made 6 movies. There were more people in the crew of those 6 movies than saw the films. So it was very frustrating. So then I happened into, you know, I saw Paranormal Activity and from another story, it's another question or another interview, got involved in the movie. And what Paranormal Activity did was it combined 15 years of my experience. It combined independent, I'd spent about, of that 15 years, about half my time in independent film and half my time in studio film. And Paranormal Activity was kind of the ultimate independent movie, made totally outside the system. but it was it couldn't have had a more traditional distributor in Paramount. Right. And so I loved that feeling of making films independently that studios would release. And that initially, and it's, you know, branched out, we've done a lot more things since then, but initially, you know, I wanted to stick with what Paranormal Activity was, which was a scary movie, and mm-hmm. see if we could duplicate that independent production and studio distribution model with other movies.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Sure. And that's what I love when I look through your list of credits. You know, amongst all these horror films, you know, Sinister, Insidious, The Purge, you get a film like Whiplash that stands out.
Yeah,
and
right.
You think, and it's almost like, to me, it kind of, it's a really poorly fleshed out analogy, but it's almost like Robin Hood, where you're making the big bucks these horror films and then you're giving to the smaller passion projects,
right?
And is that also something that you've always wanted to do?
Yeah, I don't look at it like that, because I really don't. That would imply that I'm doing the other movies to support the other movies, and I'm really not. Like, mm-hmm. I don't really believe in high-low art. I don't think James DeMonaco is any less or more talented than Damien Chazelle. I mm-hmm. really don't. No matter what kind of movie you choose to make a good movie is extremely hard, whether it's a scary movie or an art movie. I also think Whiplash I'd like to say it's like the Blumhouse version of a Sundance movie, right? Mm. It's kind of, but there are dark elements in Whiplash.
He's terrifying, isn't he?
He's J.K.
Simmons. J.K.
Simmons
is actually
a scary guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So really what I more like to say, you know, our filter is it's always low budget. We always do low budget movies, and we do low budget movies so we can try new and different things. And, you know, Whiplash would fall into that category. Get Out, Split, The Purge, mm-hmm. you know, most of the things that we've done are feel different. And that's more how I would define how Whiplash fell into the Blumhouse family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And talking of Get Out, I think, you know, the success, everyone knows what a success it's been, and it's just breaking records around the world. And Jordan Peele has obviously got now a new lease of life in a career that nobody could have seen coming. Do you think Get Out kind of has sparked this interest in horror films based on social fears as opposed to the paranormal, as opposed to ghosts and demons? Yeah.
Well, I think two things. I think, first of all, I think there's a long tradition of that. I mean, there would even before, but John Carpenter really, mm-hmm. you know, put a spotlight on, you know, making genre movies that highlighted social issues. I think The Purge laid the groundwork more recently for Get Out, and that The Purge is really about gun control in the United States, or gun control going crazy.
Yeah,
it's more of a cautionary tale, as is Get Out. And I think that it laid the groundwork for those. I think a separate question you're saying is, like, are we seeing us? I think in the early 2000s with Saw, there was a torture porn thing, which I think kind of Paranormal Activity sort of ended. And I think Paranormal Activity was the first Paranormal Activity was the beginning of this long run of supernatural scary movies. And it may be, I don't know for sure, but I feel like with The Purge and Get Out and Split, that the pendulum may be swinging towards more grounded scary thrillers as opposed to supernatural scary thrillers.
Yeah.
I think that's great. That's a great
yeah.
thing.
I think that's cool. Yeah, I don't. I mean, I have no feeling about. I like supernatural movies. Mm-hmm. You know, I like the grounded movies too. So I don't know. I'm not trying to put, and I'm not looking for those versus anything else. Like I don't like to chase the market. I like to, you know, make good things. Whatever the, I don't like to think about the market. But that may be a trend that's happening.
Sure.
I don't know.
And so as I was reading in 2015, you tweeted about. You wanted to make a film about Donald Trump, and Jordan Peele responded to that, and then you collaborate. And I mean, now do you reckon there's people us are absolutely frothing at the mouth to write a film about Donald Trump?
I think that the Trump administration, I was saying this before, is kind of seeping into, it's just starting to seep into the material that we're looking at mm-hmm. now. You know, it's not directly like some nutball dictator. In the scripts, but the spirit of the administration is starting to seep into the material that I'm looking. Art takes time, but it's just starting to happen, which is very interesting.
Yeah,
like I said, I think the Trump administration, I think, will see much better art as a result. I'd much rather have less good art and a better president, but I'll take the latter as a booby prize.
We take what we're given.
What we're given.
What is your views as like your personal views on sequels? Is that a studio thing? Do sequels kind of have to happen if the film makes money? And do you go into those projects as excited as you would making an original film?
I love sequels because they exercise. I feel like my business, I separate into about 50% of my time is in TV, 50% of my time is in movies. Mm. Of the movies, it's 50% in originals, 50% in sequels. Right. About 25-25 of my overall time. And sequels, all the rules I kind of make for myself, which I break all the time, but I kind of, the framework that I have for myself in originals, totally off the table with sequels. We get more money, mm-hmm. right? Instead of $5 million, it's more like $10 million. Right. Still by Hollywood standards low, but for us, enormous. So we have more to play with. And with sequels, I believe that art is better with parameters around the creators. And so on originals, the parameters are largely financial. On sequels, the parameters are you have to make a movie that feels enough like the previous installment that people feel like, oh, I understand why that's a sequel, yeah. but not too much like the previous installment where they feel like, oh, why did I see this? It's just like the other movie, right? Sure. And I think that's a fun puzzle to try and put together. So I think that movies have an end. I've always said, I think we made one too many Paranormal Activity movies. I wish we didn't make the last movie. I feel like it put a bad taste in people's mouth about mm-hmm. the franchise. So I regret making the last Paranormal Activity movie. We should have ended on the fifth one. So I think that they come to an end, but I do like making them, and I do like the challenge of subverting expectations. Most of our sequels, you'll notice we always include the person from the original movie, and that for scary movies is very rare. Mm. Usually you have a big hit with a scary movie, you fire the writer and director of the first one, you hire new people because it's cheaper, and usually the results aren't very good. Blair Witch 2. Mm-hmm. But we don't do that. I give away more of the profit of the movie in hopes of getting a better movie by using the original person. So James DeMonaco did The Purge movie. Scott Derrickson was on it. James Wan on Insidious. And I like the exercise that you have to go through to make sequels. So what I was going to say is I really like having both. I really like being able to go from one to the other. If we just made sequels, I'd jump out a window. And if we just made originals, I would too. Like, I really like being able to do both.
Sure. And in terms of what I find interesting as well is you've touched a few old properties, old horror films or franchises in the past. The one that springs to mind is The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah.
But you kind of subverted that by making that film exist within the film. It was great.
Yeah.
Recently it was announced that there's going to be a continuation of Halloween, which is obviously kind of the daddy of all horror
That's
films.
That's right.
But I am trusting as a long-time Halloween fan that there's a reason why you're doing this, right?
Yeah, right.
So what is that reason?
Well, a lot of it is like the expression on your face, like people are like, you're going to screw it up. So I like that, not me personally, but just should there, if another Halloween movie, it's like, oh God. So I do like subverting expectations. You know, I do like the challenge of trying to make people be like, wow, I really didn't believe that you could make a good Halloween movie today, and that they did. I really think we have the right people to do it. I really believe in David Gordon Green and Danny McBride. Like Jordan Peele, they are not from the genre world, but I don't think that matters. I think if you're talented, you can make a great genre movie. If you made a great comedy, you can make a great horror movie. Uh-huh. I'd much rather have someone who made a great comedy make a great horror movie than someone who made an okay horror movie make another horror movie.
Yeah.
But Hollywood doesn't think that way. And it is the mother of all horror movies, like, right? So of course I wanted to do it. Part of the thing that I said is I would never do it without John Carpenter's blessings, which we got. So John Carpenter's executive producing, but I'm excited. I'm going to get the script of that movie any minute. So it comes out a year and a half, and hopefully we won't disappoint people.
Yeah, it's the dream, isn't it?
It's the dream.
Yeah. And what is the formula for you to go, I'm producing this film. This is a film I'm producing.
Well, what I look for is does it feel new? You know, even with Halloween, like, we're not going to make it unless it's additive, unless it doesn't feel like we're retreading and it doesn't feel too far afield, that first sequel. But I mean, really, the first and foremost on the originals that we look for is, does it feel new? Does it feel different? Split, certainly. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a movie like that. Get Out, I really haven't seen a movie like that, right? So that's what we look. It has to be obviously good.
Yeah.
That's obvious. But in addition to being good, it can't feel like a movie we've seen before. And not all of our movies, obviously not all of our movies are past that test. Sometimes they feel much more different in the reading of them and the way the director's talking about it. They come out and it's like, oh, shit, you know, it doesn't come out like we hoped. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them do. And that's our litmus test to decide what we want to do.
Yeah, sure. And are there any films that you look back on and you think, oh, we could have done a better job with that. Maybe we'll try it again in the future.
Could have done a better job?
Yeah.
So many movies. I mean,
really?
I mean, every movie I see, I always see our mistakes that we made.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And what obstacles do you face in Hollywood as a producer?
The biggest obstacle I still face it today, is you think we've had a lot of success, and it's certainly easier than it was, but I'm still surprised that there's a lot of resistance still to our model, to, you know, it's negotiations. It's you would think people would be more inclined to jump in than they are. That's the kind of funny obstacle that I still find. Yeah.
And why do you find that they're not?
Because the system is built, because, you know, our business model is built on the notion of no one getting paid up front, and if the movies work, then everyone makes more money than they would have if they had gotten paid up front. But you have to be willing to, you know, take risks and bet on yourself, and not everyone's willing to do that. And for representation, especially, you know, if you're worried about losing your client and you suggest to them they do this, and then you're in a movie where it doesn't work and they don't get paid, you're worried about getting fired or worried about getting blamed. So I understand it, but I wish there was less resistance to it.
Hmm. And it's funny, because I assume that with a film as successful as Get Out, for example, and, you know, your name being touted as the master of horror, mm-hmm. and things like that, it would be just a no-brainer for...
I know, you would think so.
Yeah.
It's not.
Maybe I need to re-question this upping sticks.
You
and
maybe
move
need
into...
to, yeah, exactly.
You mentioned Split before, and obviously last week, Glass was announced, the sequel to Unbreakable and Split.
Yeah.
And I really love that M. Night Shyamalan has had a resurgence after a string of box office failures.
Yeah.
How do you reckon that can be attributed to a producer, kind of a director's success?
A movie's success is like, a movie's success, you learn this when you've done this a long time, is not because of any one person. I mean,
really?
I mean, it takes a great marketing mind, it takes a great director, it takes the environment in the world, you know, everything could go right and there could be a blizzard opening weekend and you're fucked.
Yeah.
So it's like a perfect storm for a success. So I think, and also obviously success has many fathers, but I think Knight was the person most responsible for Knight's turnaround is Knight. He mm-hmm. looked at the thing, he stepped back, he said, you know, I pitched him on making a low budget movie together. We didn't do the visit together. We did it. He brought it to us after he had made it. I pitched him on why to do a movie for low budget. I think he took it in. He said, all right, I'll do it myself on a low budget. And then I watched it, and then we kind of found a home for it. Mm-hmm. But But I think you know, he's a very introspective guy. He has a very good take on things, and I think I really give him credit for taking a step back, taking a step out of the system, and pulling up his bootstraps and trying again on a lower budget.
Yeah, and a film must be pretty special for you to, I'm guessing at this stage of your career, for you to look at once it's been made and go, yeah, I'm going to back this 100%.
Yeah. I felt that on the visit.
Yeah, and do you have a preference? Like, do you like to kind of steer a project from day one?
I don't care.
No?
I mean, one of the things I think that I have a big advantage over a lot of other producers is I'm never going to direct a movie. I don't want to direct a movie. I'd be a terrible director. I'm not interested in directing a movie. You know what I mean? So I don't, it's not like I'm a frustrated, like, you know, I feel like my job is to find unusual, cool, interesting things, and I help shape them and then help usher them out into the world. We did a lot of work on The Visit after I saw the movie, but you know, we had the same relationship to The Visit that we had to the first Paranormal Activity or Unfriended.
Yeah,
I mean, it's easier. It's easier to start when the movie's. At least you have a rough cut of the movie. It's
yeah,
a lot easier.
Sure.
But I don't have a preference. I don't. I feel just as much of an emotional connection to The Visit or Unfriended as I do to Sinister or Insidious. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel just as much emotional connection.
Definitely.
To those movies. Yeah.
And in terms of Glass.
Yes.
I mean, has Knight shared with you?
Yes, Knight shared. Yeah, in terms of, I have to go to Philadelphia. You know, read it with a handcuff, like,
yeah,
something like this. But I'm excited. I think I'll do that next month. I can't wait to read it. And he's talked to me a little bit about it, but very little.
Mm-hmm. That's really exciting.
Yeah.
And I mean, at the end of the day, you just love films, I guess.
I love movies and TV. I love watching. I love I love stories. I love books. I love reading. I love stories, whether they're true or fiction, whether they're books or movies or TV series. I really, really am passionate about storytelling. I really feel like, you know, it gives relevance to the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing the right job.
Doing the right job. And just to cap, what would you like, what legacy would you like your films to, going into producing, what was your ambition? What was your aim?
I'm too young to answer that question.
Okay.
Ask me in 10 years.
See you in 10 years.
All right, good.
Okay, man. Thank you.
Thank you.